Hey everyone, and welcome back to Citywide Blackout, your home for the best creators from around the world. I'm your host, Max Bowen. And joining me once again, as he's been doing for the past few weeks, Curtis Hughes. You know the name from way back in the day, and he is back, folks. Curtis, good to have you here again, buddy.
Hey, bud. Glad to be here. We've got to get this thing rocking and rolling.
Yeah, man. Let's get spooky in here. It's horror time, man. It's horror time. Now, our next guest is a very familiar one, both from his short stories and work with Cemetery Dance Publications. But now he is back with his 16th book, but his debut novel. And folks, it's one hell of a ride. Kevin Lucia joins us to talk about The Horror at Pleasant Brook. Kevin, welcome back, buddy. It's great to have you here again.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me.
All right. You know, why don't we open? Do you mind taking us on a quick stroll as to what this book is all about?
Sure. So the book actually has a very interesting origin. It has the most shallow origin I could possibly imagine. Okay. Long story short, at my old school, which I no longer teach, we have these sub-basements where they did, it basically is like World War II bomb shelters that they now use for like storage. And they're really creepy and vibey, and it's cool to take the history teacher takes kids down there for like a World War II lesson. I've taken my creative writing kids down there to kind of like soak up the atmosphere. But one year we were doing a ghost walk for like charity throughout our school, and we were setting it up, and I'm like, we got to set up something in the sub basement. And I went in there, and in the middle of the sub basement is this absolutely grotesque rubber mask just laying on the floor, and it's like, why is this even in here? It's got this big gaping mouth. It's got these bulging eyes that look in different directions. It's got this stringy hair. And I'm like, why is this here? For years, it's been the story that there's a master key that seniors pass down, and that there's been stories of kids sneaking in there in between classes and things like that. So that's kind of like a well-known secret. But I'm just looking at this thing just laying there in the dust. It's one of those. The mask is actually in here in my horror crave. And I'm like, what is that doing there? And for some reason, I was I wanted to start doing an online writing exercise. So this just started out very simply titled The Mask. And I started writing this thing online about people who found this mask. No, this one guy finds this mask, and for some weird reason, he's compelled to put it on. And then it just transforms him and then replicates. And then it kind of petered out, for a little bit, because I got busy with other things. But then I finally, I'm like, this really could be a novel, and I pulled it off the website so it wasn't there anymore and started rewriting it. And then I'm just like, you know what? I said, I tend to write quiet horror. That's what I tend to write. And I love it, and I'm never going to abandon it. But I'm like, we just need to see how many people I can kill in this book. How many people can I kill, and how many different ways can I kill them? And right, exactly. So I'd get the chapter 10 and be like, no one's had their spine ripped out yet. And it feels like a spine should be ripped out in this chapter. So that's what it eventually, that's what it originally was just a how gory and bloody can I make this? But of course, along the way, I adore character development. That's my wheelhouse. And I also was thinking, at the time, I was really binging on 80s horror, like watching a lot of old school 80s small town horror. And there was one that I really like called Mutant with Wings Hauser. If you haven't seen it, it's on Tubi, because Tubi is life. Everything that you could possibly imagine on Tubi. And it's a great take on vampire, zombie, whatever. But it's so misogynistic. And it's like, I love Wings Hauser, but it's your typical, they're running away from the monsters, the girl twists her ankle and goes, I can't go on! He's like, smack, get yourself back together! And I'm just like, holy cow, this is like so awful. So as I was writing it, I wanted to write something that was solidly, its DNA was that 80s small town creature feature horror. But I wasn't intentionally trying to subvert those tropes, but I just wanted to make it modern. How would this look like in today's society? And that's developing the characters, and then, we were off to the races, and that's the end product is what you have.
Oh, my God. Yeah, one of the things I loved about the book, and as you mentioned earlier, character development. You put a lot of love into your characters. There are no cannon fodder here. Everyone. I mean, I'm only in chapter 6 right now, but having met Bobby, the high school, you know, the former high school football star who, oh shit.
Yeah, he's a bad guy.
He is not a good person. Yeah. He is not a good person.
No, not at all.
And of course, meeting Lisa and Robert and Grace, who's like the town sheriff, basically. Each character has a great deal of life inside them.
Yep.
So the question I want to pose to you, Kevin, is when it comes to making your characters, how much time do you spend just kind of building these people and building their backstories?
Well, I would say that there's probably a good – I can't remember who it was that told me this. It was either – I don't know if you're familiar with Rio Yours. The author Rio Yours, he's a wonderful author. But I remember talking to him about how, you know, I'll end up writing like 5 or 6 pages of backstory, and then realize I don't really need those for the story, but I needed them for the character. You know, so there's a lot where you'll end up shaving away after a while, but it's like there's something about writing characters that I really enjoy. So it's on NetGalley, and it's mostly gotten really, really good reviews on NetGalley. A couple people are complaining that I gave too full of backstories to everyone. But I love doing that. Like, I just, when I start developing a character, even if I plan on killing that character off at the end of the chapter, I just start getting curious about who they are as a person. And that's what it is, I think, is that I'm just curious. I'll never forget one of the best advice that I ever got in one of my early creative writing classes, and I may have even been in, like, junior college, was to just go in a public place where, you know, it's like a park or something like that. And, you know, not, you know, like somewhere where it would be acceptable to watch people, but not be creepy, and just watch them, watch their mannerisms, watch how they listen to how they speak and things like that. And I remember a turnkey moment for me was at the time I was writing science fiction. I was in college and it was all really bad. It wasn't really science fiction. It was like it sounded like someone had taken Star Wars fan fiction and Star Trek fan fiction, just kind of jammed it together. That's really what it was. You know, it wasn't really very good though. Instead of hyperspeed, hyper, like, it's just bad stuff. And all the characters were the same. They all totally were the same. But I got a job. I mean, everyone goes through those periods in their life, especially during college, where they get that job that they do not want at all, but they're like broke. So I got a job at a gas station in a bad part of town, third shift, 11 at night, 7 in the morning. It was right down the road from this, from like 3 strip clubs. So we had an interesting clientele that would come through. And there were 2 things that really pinged me as a writer. The first one was one of my coworkers just got talking about her life one night, and she was lower middle class. She was a single mom, you know, dealing with a deadbeat dad who wasn't paying child support and things like that. And it just hit me that all my characters were white, upper middle class, no problems, square jaw, blonde hair, dashing good looks. None of them had any personal demons. And I was listening to this lady tell me her life. And I'm like, this is real. This is real. And then a little contradiction. So one night, again, we were down the road from several strip clubs. So we had at 3 a.m. what we like to call our stripper run. Strippers would come in, get their stuff. And of course, I am a young 20-something-year-old young man who's like, these strippers, woo! You know, and very sheltered, right? So this one girl comes in and she's very, very attractive and things like that. I think she may still have glitter on her face or whatever. She goes to buy, you know, she comes up to the cash register and she's like got 3 packs of cigarettes and like a stack of cat food. And that's all she's getting. I'm like, first of all, and I'll sound stupid, you're like, she has a cat. But I'm just like, oh, she's buying. She's just going home to her cat. She's a stripper who's been doing whatever all night. And I don't want to judge strippers. I'm not like being judgmental from that. But you know, as in my 20-year-old, very inexperienced and unconsciously misogynistic, you know, perspective, she's a stripper doing these things, but she's going home, and her priority is bringing home cat food for her cat. And that was a character trait contradiction. And I'm like, that's interesting, you know, that's interesting. And when I start developing characters, I just start thinking of all these little ticks and quirks that I find interesting. I want to know more about them, even if I totally plan on killing them within five paragraphs. I want, and you know what? That's unfortunate. Not unfortunately, that is the heritage of Stephen King, because I've also always felt there are some authors where when people have died, I've been like, eh. But then when Stephen King kills people, I'm like, you son of a bitch. I can't believe you killed him, you know? And that's the way I am. You know, I don't feel like you can have any real empathy about somebody dying unless we know who this person is. So,
Yeah. You know, you mentioned 80s horror. And I think especially what we see from certain horror series, you see characters that just don't matter. They get killed. Right. You know, like, whatever. Didn't give a shit then. Don't give a shit now. But with your characters, one thing I'm really loving is that each one is like, could be their own book, basically. You could right. do the book of Bobby. You could do the book right. of Grace. You could do the book of right. Lisa and Robert. Right. So there's, I really like that depth here. Now, to give people an idea as to the opening for this story and where it goes, we have Lisa and Robert. They're kind of an estranged couple. They are going through child issues, and this has led to her husband cheating on Lisa, which she is fully aware of. And she, through her work as an art museum, has discovered the means to fix things, shall we say. I want to say, dude, the first... yeah, exactly. Something that will basically make the pain go away, and it gets so much worse. In the first couple chapters, you had me scared shitless, okay? I won't spoil anything, guys. Read the book. But you had me scared shitless from that first couple chapters. So in terms of writing,
we were talking about that too, Max.
Yeah.
Right, you know, before we came on started. And I told you, I said, I'm usually not a fan of the horror novels, the genre per se, but I got sucked in immediately.
Right.
Within the first four pages, I was sucked in and ready to go.
Yeah. Oh my God. So yeah, like, and that I think is the strength of the characters along with the story, but you can't have a good story without good characters, I feel like. Now, as I mentioned at the outset of the interview, this is your 16th book, but your first novel, and I'll explain this one, folks, because prior to this, you had done like collections, novellas, and short stories. So writing your first book, what did you have to do to sort of shift gears?
Well, the novel is something that I've struggled with for many, many years. There have been many failed novels before this. And I think I can't even tell you how I did it. That's the funny thing. I really can't, because what would happen is I would get about 500 pages in and then it would just collapse under the weight of itself. You know what I mean? It just didn't. But I think what happened with the horror at Pleasant Brook is I was able to finally, like, I think I wanted for a long time. I don't know how much of Peter Straub's work you've read. I think I wanted like ghost story and things like that. I wanted to write big novels like that that were super intricate and things. But I would try that and they would just fall apart. But I realized that with the horror at Pleasant Brook, if the plot is still simple enough, you can bring your complexity to the characters, not necessarily. Like, I was trying to make really twisty, complex, non-linear, you know, because that's what Peter Straub does so well, and he's very literary. And I don't want to say I was trying to be very literary, but I wanted, you know... I wanted to have that same importance that I felt about my short stories and my novellas with the novel. But with the horror at Pleasant Brook, what I realized was if you just keep the plot fairly simple, you can put all your complexity in the characters, and then that's what's going to carry it through. It's the same thing with my second novel, which is coming out in November from Crossroads Press, Billy the Kid and Lazarus Stone. That was very much a race to the finish, shoot 'em up Western. But because I kept the plot and I outlined that one, that's actually one of the few things I've ever outlined, because I outlined that and I knew where it was going, I was able to really dive into Billy as a character and really try to figure out his quirks. And I mean, there's so much myth about, like, what I found is in New Mexico, Billy is like akin to Jesus down there. Like, I mean, he's that mythical of a character that there's, like, you know, all these different stories about him. So when I made the plot for that novel fairly straightforward, then I could just apply it to the characters. Like, the next novel I have in mind is basically cursed school. You know how many times we see that? Where school gets cursed and students start getting picked off one at one. And I'm going to keep it simple, because then that way it'll allow me to bring that complexity to the characters. So
I like that. Very cool. Now, in terms of the writing process, now you've worked in the horror field for many years, working with the fine folks at Cemetery Dance Publications. Did that help kind of prepare you for writing this book at all?
Well, the funny thing about that is, remember, I've only been working for Cemetery Dance for about a year and a half. So the book was mostly, I will say this, from a marketing perspective, yes. Because having worked for Cemetery Dance and launching all of these other books and then seeing how Richard Chismar launches his books, that gave me a couple, like, well, this is, and I, you know, there's a couple contacts that I built up working in Cemetery Dance that I was then able to rely upon for the horror Pleasant book. And I would see how, you know, an author would be like, for example, Philip Fracassi's Gothic, which I don't know if you read that, read Gothic. So he was the first author that wanted to be on NetGalley. And I put it on NetGalley. And when I saw all those reviews coming in, I'm like, I'm putting my book on NetGalley. I don't care if I have to foot the bill myself. I'm going to put it on NetGalley. And so I think more from that aspect, not so much the writing of the book, but how I'm marketing it. Like, I've got a pre-order special right now where if you pre-order it now, you'll get a signed copy with an additional limited edition novelette that I'm a chapbook that I'm not, you know, publishing anywhere else. And this is all stuff that I've gleaned from the way Cemetery Dance does stuff. So mostly from the marketing angle, that has really helped me out a lot.
Oh, cool.
As far as the skills that you've learned and picked up, is there anything that helped you specifically to avoid any sort of, like, pitfalls or, you know, stuff like that other authors you have maybe seen, you know, have run into?
I don't know about what other authors have done. I just know the things that I have, you know, like, for example, I've always been very exposition heavy, you know, and like I said, some of that's necessary for me, but there's been times where I'll write 10 pages and be like, no, the story starts here. You know, early on, I would think every author's like, this is my baby. Every word here is sacred. But I had a good friend years ago who was editing my work, and he noted about 7 pages down. He's like, your story really starts here. And then when I looked at all the information before it, I'm like, gosh darn it, he's right. You know, so it's mostly stuff that I've learned on my own. You know, probably one of the biggest lessons was about cliched characters, you know, as far as when you're talking about stereotypes, racial stereotypes and things like that, because I think we've all got blind spots, you know, it's and things like that. And the first incarnation of Billy the Kid was first completed 12 years ago, the very first iteration of Billy the Kid, and one of the characters was half white, half Apache Indian. And one of my friends who beta read it, he came back and he said, I'm conflicted. This one half Indian character is badass. He said, people are going to look at this and they're going to think you've created a magical Indian. And I'm like, what the heck is a magical Indian? I just never heard it before. So I went and Googled magical Indian. I'm like, shit. I wrote a magical Indian. You know, the idea that he's Indian and the only reason why he's Indian is so he can be mystical. You know, he could be any other character, but I made him one with nature, because so it's little stuff like that. So that what that helped me is there's been, as of late, I felt the burden to try to diversify my characters more. Female characters, people of color, you know, LGBT plus characters. So when I do that, I make sure I run it through a sensitivity reader first because of that one experience, you know. So I've got several people who are, or for example, one of the characters in the horror at Pleasant Brook is non-binary. And I had one of my students who's a senior who is non-binary. So I just sat down and explained to them what I was doing. And I was like, if you were looking and reading a book and you wanted to see a non-binary character, what are you looking like? How do you want to see it presented? You know, because I want to do it faithfully and I want to do it right, you know. So that's probably one of the things that I've learned along the lines there, too. Other than that, I don't have a lot of – seems like the problems I get into, I just write myself out of them. I you know, if I hit a roadblock – oh, I will say this. A lot of times I've learned that a story screeches to a halt doesn't mean it's done. It doesn't mean – like, so at one point I thought Billy the Kid was dead in the water, was never going to see life ever again. And I just – but I just put it in a trunk and just said, not now. Mm-hmm. Maybe 2 or 3 years down the road. So I always feel like a story just kind of peters out. It doesn't mean that story's dead. It's just not now. Mm-hmm. Maybe. And then that's probably why it seems like I've got this whole swell of books that are coming out, because these are a lot of not nows that in the last 2 or 3 years, I'm like, oh, now, now I'm ready to finish these now.
Mm, definitely. I want to pick up with the topic of diversity in horror, because, you know, very early in the book, we're introduced to Grace, who is a lesbian, and Sage, who goes by they and them. And I really like that we have that kind of diversity. Is that thing has been around in horror for a while, or is it more of a recent development with the genre?
I think it's definitely a recent development. I think it's a recent development that's a long time in coming, you know. But again, 10 years ago, it wasn't even on my radar. Like, I wouldn't even thought about it. Like, occasionally, Stephen King would offer a gay character. Or if you read Clive Barker would write about gay characters. But you just didn't really think about it. And I think there's been a lot in the last 5 or 6 years that's really broached that question of representation. And obviously, we've seen that there's has not always been received favorably, which I think is kind of silly. You know, it's kind of like having better representation in horror does not then mean that all the white characters are going to go away or all the white authors are no longer. That's just, to me, that's silly. But when you think about being a writer, even if I don't even want to necessarily take credit for being this diverse person. As a writer, you want to be able to capture life as faithfully as possible. There are lesbians who live in our world. There are LGBT non-binary. I know, right? And they have lives. And I feel weird saying this, but I don't want to be like that guy who says, I'm a feminist, you know, like Joss Whedon. But so I want to be careful there, because I don't want to co-opt a movement that's not mine that I don't know anything about. But as a writer, you would think that once something like this has been brought to your awareness, you're like, I've never written that character before. I want to try to write that character, but I also want to have someone read it to make sure that I'm not falling into any. I think it's a great thing, you know, and I also think, too, if you're a skilled writer and you want to capture humanity, I don't know why you'd be afraid of it. I don't know why you'd be resistant to it. It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Unless you're resistant to those people actually existing. And then that becomes the, you know, they'll it's like a dog whistle, right?
Yeah,
they'll
exactly.
Complain all day long about the agenda and these poor white writers that can't write anymore. What you're really doing is, if you're offended by these characters in fiction, that implies that you're basically offended by them existing. Which, again, that's very telling to me.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? I think I know who we're referring to. But we're gonna move along because we're here to talk about.
I don't have anyone. Oh, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yep. That guy.
There are so many others though too that just even I know personally, who they just get up in arms even about the idea of having a sensitivity reader. Like, there's a whole bunch of, you know, oh, censorship. No, stupid. That's not. You don't know the definition of censorship.
I feel like having a sensitivity reader involved is the same thing as having an editor involved. You have the editor to, you know, fact check your book and make sure everything makes sense. The sensitivity reader is there for that very same reason.
Like, for example, I early on, my very first book ever called Hiram Grange and the Chosen One, you know, I knew nothing about guns. You know, so I had Googled these guns And then when I had, luckily my editor at Shroud, Tim Deal, was from the military, and he gave me some notes back. And he's like, this is actually like an airsoft, you know, paint gun rifle, LOL. You know, so that he was, and then I had the book set in Ireland. So he had a friend of his who was from Ireland read it. And his comment was, it's a really great book, but your description of Ireland reads like somebody who's from the U.S. who read about Ireland on Wikipedia. So having a sensitivity reader is just another type of specific beta reader. Like it exactly. doesn't, they're not gatekeepers. Yeah. Put it this way. If there's something in your book that's troubling enough toward LGBT, then that's an indication of something troubling in your character, not just in your writing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let us talk a little more about the mask, because I love how the backstory of this is something you randomly found in the basement of a school, which could be its own story, too. That could be its own separate horror story.
Seriously.
Yeah, that's downright terrifying. And reading what we've read, holy shit, man. Holy shit.
And I also have to say, you know, reading the first, you know, chapter or so in, I totally didn't expect the mask to come into play here at all.
Right. Exactly. So yeah, definitely a curveball, but a welcome curveball.
I did a little research on that. So the mask, so it's good. You're going to get into the mythology of it. And of course, most mythology and books like this are taken piecemeal from different places. But what I found was a wooden mask from folklore that was worn during certain ceremonies to forget troubles or things like that. And I'm like, I always like finding that nice little mythological. I tweaked it so much throughout the book. I have had one person so far who called me out on my use of mythology because they happen to be a pagan themselves, which is fine. I mean, you can't. When you do stuff like that, you figure I just got to make it credible. You know, like for example, in Billy the Kid, at one point I had to stop myself when it came to talking about bullets and casings and how to make silver bullets, because I'm like, I'm not writing a manual on how to make silver bullets in the 1800s. You know, yes, maybe a gun nut is going to be like, oh, you got that casing thing wrong there. But what's the likelihood of all of my readers being gun nuts? But yeah, so I looked it up a little bit and I found a wooden mask and things like that. And it was just so eerie finding that mask in the middle. And that's the way the original draft online started, was a school custodian finding it in the sub basement and for some reason being compelled to put it on. Obviously I rewrote that because in the end I had no good reason for it to be in this bit, so I had to come up with a much better backstory for it. But
mm-hmm. Okay.
It's grotesque. It's awful.
It's terrible.
And I used to bring it I brought it back to my classroom. And I would hang it up every year for Halloween. And my kids, the kids that were horror fans, would be like, you realize you've just doomed us all to a horrible death. And I'm like, yes, I know. Sorry.
Exactly. This is, Kevin, you know better, Kevin. You know better. This is exactly what's going to happen. One of the kids is going to put it on. He's going to become some sort of psychotic demon. And then you're a smear on the wall. You know this.
Yep.
Jeez. All right. Curtis, that's just take it away, man. Take it away.
Well, bringing it back to character development and just a love for writing them for the book, The Horror of Pleasant Brook. You know, was there any character particularly in the book that you found either difficult or complex to write, or conversely, real easy and kind of meaningful to write?
Bobby was hard because he's such a terrible person. He was awful. They're an awful person. And there is a couple of times there where I thought I would cut some corners and make him less of an awful person. And I'm just like, no. There was one reviewer who said he might have been worse even before he got the mask on. And I'm like, that was kind of what I was going for, that he was just a garbage human being.
Accurate.
So his scenes were difficult to write. I loved writing Grace. You know, I loved writing Grace as the town constable, and kind of reconciling the fact that she used to be in a bigger city. Now she's in a one horse town, her one horse town growing up. And I enjoyed writing her, because she was the modern riff off that. Like, how many of these, you know, like how many times have we seen in the Halloween movies with the Haddonfield sheriffs, or, you know, or some small town. Sure. a movie where the sheriff, you know, and I'm thinking this is the modern incarnation of that. So I wanted her to have that type of vibe so that old school horror fans are going to read her and see that DNA in her. But I wanted her to be representative of 2022. I don't know if you guys have met Marty yet. You guys haven't met Marty yet.
No, not yet.
No,
Marty. Yeah. So Marty and Jenny, I think. Maybe it's Jenny. I don't know. I really enjoyed them because they're really good people. They're really good people. And I enjoyed writing about them. And I enjoyed writing about Scott because, again, your classic horror. Have you gotten Scott yet?
No, I'm on chapter 6 now.
Okay, so when you get to Scott is your classic 14-year-old kid who's a horror nerd. He's the horror nerd in the horror movie who knows everything about horror. But I wanted him to be a kid that was from 2022, you know, and to be dealing with, you know, so you understand what I mean when you get there. I want him to be dealing with 2022 problems, not necessarily 1985 problems. So,
you know, you mentioned that, and I really liked that part because this book is set in the middle of the COVID pandemic. You know, schools are remote. Events are being canceled, much to the chagrin of some people in this town.
Those guys are fun too.
Oh my God, yeah. I'm kind of curious as to why do that. Why set this right in the middle of this thing that we would all love to forget ever happened?
So when COVID was going on, I think probably like a lot of people, I had no desire to write whatsoever. But I thought to myself very vividly. I remember, so the horror cave here is my downstairs space, and it's got a separate entrance outside. And I remember very vividly just standing outside and looking outside. And we live out in the country, so it's always quiet anyway. But everything just seemed so dead. Like it was just dead. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't feel like writing right now. But this is a vibe that we're going to use later, you know, because I feel it right now. We've all gone to sleep, and I wasn't a COVID denier by any means. If the quarantine was necessary, we had to do something, you know. But even so, even knowing something was the right choice, we were all going to sleep and slowly fading away. And I remember thinking to myself, you can't write now because you're not feeling it, but this is going to be useful. And again, the story wasn't, and it doesn't technically in the COVID pandemic. So it's about a year or two after COVID. But I know being a teacher, there were so many spikes afterward where we were like, oh my God, are we going to remote school again? I don't think I can do this. So that was my own personal nightmare in this book, is that yes, this one small community, there's so many big spikes, they're going to go remote schooling again. And again, Salem's Lot. Stephen King. That was a dead town before the vampires ever showed up. But it was dead for other reasons. It was dead because of prejudice. It was dead because of a closed-mindedness. But for example, the vampires were able to move so stealthily through Salem's Lot because everybody was in their own little, even though everybody knew everyone else's business and it was incestuous, they also were terribly isolated people at the same time. And I'm like, yeah, we're going to try to capture some of that vibe. And you're going to see some of that Salem's Lot vibe in this novel. But I want it to be 2020. And even though I agreed with the quarantine, and even though I thought it was necessary, it still divided us. It still isolated us into our homes and cut us off from everyone. And like, I remember as a teacher, staring at Zoom boxes all eerily like this, only like 30 of them, and being like, oh, Sammy, Bobby, and Ricky didn't show up today. Who cares? You know, and like if the evil was threading its way through a town like that, what teacher or principal is going to care after a while as little boxes start going black or you log in and your teacher never logs in? If you're an average kid, you're going to be like, oh, well, and go about and do your thing. So it seemed to be that. Again, Salem's Lot, that deadness, but with now. Mm. And then I was also able finally to mine all those feelings that I felt during the COVID pandemic at a safe distance.
Okay.
Setting this in a small town,
isolated? What kind of was the COVID-19, pandemic thing? Was that the premise of why it was put into the scene into the small town, or did it have a bigger role than that?
Always in the small town. I just like small town horror. I grew up in a small town. You know, I grew up in a small town, actually very similar to Pleasant Brook, where there wasn't even a police force. You know, there was a main street and a school and a church or two, and that was about it. You know, and it's, as you're going to see throughout the scope of the book, small towns are neither good nor evil. They simply are, and they're filled with all sorts of people. So you're going to meet a lot of annoying people throughout this book, a lot of people who are good people, a lot of people who you're going to feel sad that they die, a lot of people that you really like. And that's what a small town really is. It's all of it, and but then it's so small. And like I said, that's a weird thing I think about small towns is small towns are very, having lived in one, they're ironically very incestuous and that everybody knows everything about each other, but yet everyone's still trapped in their own little world. So they're also oddly separated from each other. Mm-hmm. So I just like small town horror.
Yeah.
I've never actually written anything in the city. That would probably be a challenge that I would need to try someday, but everything I usually write is small town horror.
Yeah. This actually reminds me of the last time we spoke of your book, and forgive me if I'm getting the name wrong, but I think it was October Nights.
October Nights, yep.
And that was set in the town of Clifton Heights, which you had sort of built over the years, and it had become one of your main settings for a lot of your works.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, and this novel started out as a Clifton Heights novel. I don't want to give anything away from the novel, but I realized I was restraining the evil so that I could keep writing Clifton Heights stories.
Mm.
And I'm like, that's not serving the story.
Ah, okay.
That's serving your agenda. You know, I don't know where the story is going, but I was trying to build in checks and balances against the monster and trying to come up with all these crazy explanations so that at the end of the book, we can have our classic Clifton Heights ending. This could also be why I have yet to write a Clifton Heights novel, because that's when you're writing in a mythos like that, it's a little. So I realized very early on, this can't be a Clifton Heights novel because you're not letting the story breathe. You're not serving the story.
Okay.
So.
All right. Curtis, of course, asked the big question of, you know, characters that are meaningful. I want to talk about scenes. Where this is a horror book, of course, the kill scenes or the jump scare scenes are the big things. But was there any scene that you found particularly important or just a scene that you loved writing?
It's hard because I liked all the scenes, right?
They're all winners.
I love the ending. I love the ending. Again, I don't want to... I don't want to give it away. There's 100 chapters in it, 98 chapters, 99 chapters, something like that. So somewhere around chapter 94, I kind of slammed the gas pedal to the floor. Oh. And that was a lot of fun to write that ending. It was a lot of fun to write that ending. I really like writing the panoramic scenes, like toward the end of the novel. Like, one of the things I've always loved about Stephen King, especially in Salem's Lot, there's a passage in Salem's Lot where he writes an omniscient narrative, and he just kind of goes across Salem's Lot and the town and what it's like and all the people. So I do that a couple times in the horror of Pleasant Brook, but also toward the end, as the town gets more and more deserted, but yet we still have, like, in front yards, Halloween decorations kind of. You ever see the opening to Halloween 4?
Mm-hmm.
Opening montage. So imagine a nice, long, extended sequence like that with our characters driving in a car, and they're wondering if they're the only ones left. And we just have these montages of these front lawns, like with the only thing that's there are abandoned Halloween decorations. I really enjoyed writing those.
Okay. All right. Any kind of horror elements you tried to avoid with this book because maybe it was tropey or overused or you just didn't like it?
Ironically, the only tropes I was concerned about was the ones with, like, the, you know, misogynistic, the 80s. You know, honestly, as far as the kills and things like that, I didn't even worry about it.
Oh.
I'm just like, there's going to be intestines munching. There's going to be disemboweling. There's going to be face is ripped off. It's just what I wanted. So I, whether or not that came off tropey, and like I said, it's some tropes are, as far as I'm concerned, some tropes are okay if they're tried and true. I mean, this is basically the outcast of a small town band together to try to defend it.
I like that.
It's not brand new. It's not brand new, but I would hope that my outcasts are different.
Let's talk about the outcasts. Yeah, because
that's what I'm hoping, because my outcasts are not the same ensemble of outcasts you normally have.
How did you make them different? How, what did you have to do to kind of make this set of outcasts unique?
Well, like I said, I wanted to keep it like 2022. We have a lesbian sheriff who's running from what was basically sexual harassment in her old job. And not only sexual harassment in her old job, but her girlfriend in her old job wanted her to keep quiet about it, so she came home. We have the non-binary town librarian who, I don't know if you caught it, the non-binary town librarian and the lesbian sheriff were a couple at one point. So they're dealing with that, which again, that would usually be the male sheriff with the pretty waitress, and they're dealing with the romantic tension between the two and why their relationship fall apart. Same dynamic. It's not new, but the people are new. When you get to Scott, you're going to see that he's going through a very common coming of age. Oh, wow. I can't believe I did that. But again, it's not the usual kind. Then I have two other outcasts. Julie's a stripper, who's a recovered alcoholic. So she's consciously still working in an environment where she has to avoid booze every single day. And she's a good person, but this is her job. And then we have Marty, which I don't think you've met Marty yet either. Marty's also a recovered alcoholic and sort, I don't want to say he's a devout Catholic, but he's kind of a Catholic. So we have all these set pieces that they're recognizable. Like I said, I'm sure people are going to see the horror DNA there and be like, oh, this isn't anything new. No, it's not necessarily new. Hopefully the characters are new. One of my favorite characters that did not get much screen time at all is the bouncer at the strip club who considers himself a devout Christian. And he believes it was God's mission for him to be at the strip club to protect his girls. And he was one of my favorite characters that didn't end up getting the screen time that I would have loved to see him get. But
Okay. All right, folks, we are coming down to the end of the conversation, but I do want to ask about getting to work with Crystal Lake Publishing. This is the company releasing the book later on in October. How was it to be able to team up with them for the book?
So, I mean, they're my publisher. They published my very first collection, Things Slip Through, and they've published 5 of my books, 6 of my books. And I had a novella in their Dark Waters series, October's End. Joe Meinhardt's great. You know, Joe is tireless. He's hardworking. He promotes. You know, he's, I think he's been pretty smart too. A lot of publishers, we've seen a lot of small publishers rise and fall for various reasons, whether it be overextending themselves, not paying their writers, getting vocally involved in things on social media that they shouldn't be, and then torpedoing their whole publishing company because of it. Joe stays out of those things. He is utterly professional. There's been times where he scaled back Crystal Lake because he's like, I can't lose the company. We have to keep it alive. You know, and he would ask me, like, I remember very early on, my first couple of books, we got a deal with, you know, we got a distribution deal with Ingram. It was really exciting to have my books in brick and mortar stores. But then we realized the returns were getting sent to him in South Africa. And it was going to, because with small press books, any books that aren't sold get returned to the publisher. But he's in South Africa. So these books are getting shipped to international rates. And he's like, Kevin, I said, I'm going to have to take a bunch of books down off of Ingram because it's going to ruin me as a publisher. Are you okay? I'm like, sure, obviously. You got to do what you got to do. We eventually figured a way around that. But he's willing to, you know, okay, this sucks and I don't want to do this, but Crystal Lake has to stay alive. You know, and he's been great about that. He's very innovative when it comes to marketing. He's hardworking. He's been a pleasure to work with.
man, I got to say once again, I am loving the book, The Horror at Pleasant Brook, coming to you from Crystal Lake Publishing later on in October. Great time of the year, frankly, for it. Perfect. But the big question that everyone wants to know is what's next?
What's next? So in the spring, either one of two things. I just finished the final editing on a big short story collection called When the Lights Go Out, that's coming from Cemetery Dance Publications. Either that's going to come out in the spring, or I have another novella that's with a publisher right now that'll come out in the spring. I already have another book sitting with Crystal Lake in November of 2024. It's another Clifton Heights book. It's another, like, October Nights. It's the four novellas, and it's called We All Go Into the Dark. So that's the stuff that's all official. So.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Kevin, man, it's coming to a close way too soon, but I gotta say, this has been a lot of fun, and folks, get the book, all right? Simple as that. Pre-order it now.
Get it out there.
Exactly. Pre-order the book now. You get a signed copy plus a novella you will find nowhere else.
Right
off the bat, folks, you get something really big. And as we always say, support the author however you can. Leave reviews, follow their socials, interact with them. It's all part of bringing everything up. And Kevin, thanks again. And of course, looking forward to the next conversation.
As am I.
Hey guys, what's going on? This is Brian Murphy from One Time Mountain, and you're listening to Citywide Blackout with Max Bowen.
Rock on.
And that brings this episode to a close. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow the show on Facebook under Citywide Blackout and Twitter and Instagram under Citywide Max. You can find this show on your favorite podcast platforms, and new episodes are added every week, as well as every Saturday at 10 p.m. on Boston Free Radio. You can get at me at citywidemax@yahoo.com. Whether you want to suggest a guest, submit music for the bi-weekly Blackout Collection playlist, or just say hello. That's all for now, and I'll see you next time.